Chapter 10. The Surprise lay off Mezentheron, moored in 15-fathom water, pitching gently as she gazed at the harbour, a harbour silted up long since and now full of tree trunks from the last flood of the river that meandered through the low-lying, unhealthy town. Two castles guarded the tree trunks and the score of small craft inside the harbour. The castles had once belonged to Venice, and the winged lion of St. Mark still stood in bold relief upon their outward walls, but now they flew the Turkish crescent. The frigate had saluted them on dropping anchor, and they had replied, the roar of cannon sending up clouds of pelicans from an unseen lagoon. But since then nothing had happened. Nothing to the purpose, that is to say. The pelicans had recovered their wits, flying back in long, straight lines to their brackish mud, and the fishing boats continued to mill about in the harbour, spearing squids as they rose to the surface in the ecstasies of ten-armed copulation. Yet no canopied official boat shoved off from the castle jetty, no pasha showed his horse-tail banner, and aboard the frigate there was a distinct sense of anticlimax. A sailor's eye would have seen that she was even trimmer than usual, with her furled sails skinned up in the bunt, and her head braces lying in perfect Flemish fakes, while even a landsman would have noticed that the officers had abandoned their usual working clothes of easy nankeen pantaloons and light jackets for undress uniform and Hessian boots, while the bargemen were already in their snowy trousers, bright blue jackets, and best straw hats, ready to row their captain ashore as soon as he was invited. Yet the invitation did not come. The castle showed no sign of life, and Captain Aubrey was certainly not going to make the first move. He sat in his great cabin, elegantly and even splendidly dressed, but for the fact that his gold-laced coat lay on a chair and his patriotic fund 100-guinea sword beside it, while his neckcloth was as yet untied and his breeches unbuckled at the knee. He was drinking a supplementary pot of coffee and eating biscuits with a fine equanimity, fully prepared either to see Ismail Bey, if that gentleman appeared or sent a proper message, or to sail northward for an interview with Mustafa. Or failing Mustafa, then with Sayahan Bey in Kutali itself. He had wished to see his three Turks in regular succession, travelling up the coast from Ismail's Mezentheron to Mustafa's Karya, and so past Marga and its Frenchmen to Kutali, thus spending the least possible time in preliminaries. But with such a delicate mission as this, he was certainly not going to allow himself to fret over details, and if his Turks did not chance to be at home as he passed by, then he would take them in another order. In any event, he intended to be at sea, well out at sea, before the evening. At quarters yesterday the ship's gunnery had disappointed him, and although the hands tearing high spirits over the prize had something to do with their criminal levity and indifferent shooting, it was also true that they were not yet quite at home with the frigate's guns. A couple of hours' steady practice, live practice, would do wonders, even though it meant burning much of the powder he had taken out of the prize. Ismail's absence did not vex him unduly, therefore, but it did puzzle him. In these circumstances, where the cannon he could provide would probably mean victory to any one of the three sides, he had expected an eager welcome. Janissaries playing a Turkish march, fireworks, perhaps an Oriental carpet laid out. Was this apparent indifference Turkish policy, a common manoeuvre in the East? He would have liked to ask Professor Graham, but early in the day, as soon as the mountains of Epirus grew clear on the eastern sky, the professor and Dr. Maturin had made their way into the maintop, helped and guarded by Honey and Maitland, both master's mates and both powerful young men, there to survey the classic ground. It was not Attica, it was not even Boeotia, but it was still just Greece, and the poor young gentlemen were bored to a galloping pallor, intolerably bored with accounts of Theopompus and the Molossians, of Agathocles and the Molossians, of Themistocles and the Molossians, with his speech at full length of the Actian games and even of the Battle of Actium itself, though neither Graham nor Maturin could remember which side had the weather gauge. Their only relief from boredom came when Graham, in the heat of declamation, Plutarch on Pyrrhus, stepped backwards into the lubber's hole, and when they were sent down for maps and an azimuth compass so that it might be determined which mountain on the skyline concealed Dodona and its speaking oak. "Dodona, young gentleman, which Homer describes as the hole of the Selle, who sleep upon the ground and do not wash their feet."
Perhaps that is Graham, thought Jack, hearing someone speaking to the sentry at the cabin door.
But no, it was Stephen, attracted by the smell of coffee wafting up, and perhaps a little overcome by Graham's elephantine memory. He was now treating the master's mates to Polybius, Dionysus of Halicarnassus, and Pausanias, all of them on the subject of Pyrrhus, born and nurtured in those blue-grey mountains ahead.
I was thinking of Graham, said Jack.
So was I, Stephen instantly replied. The other day he explained to me that the Navy was a school for cowardice, and I meant to ask you for some heads of argument on the other side. I was reminded of his contention as I came down just now, because I heard a midshipman reproving a foremast hand.
How did Graham make this out? Asked Jack. Killick, light along another cup.
He began by saying that he had seen an admiral throw an inkwell at a post-captain, and that the post-captain, a choleric and masterful man, overcame his desire to retaliate by a very great exertion of self-discipline, explaining afterwards that if he had raised his hand to his superior officer, it would have been the end of his career, even in theory of his life. Graham observed that the admiral could blackguard and even assault the captain with impunity, just as the captain could blackguard and even assault his lieutenants, and they their inferiors, and so on, to the penultimate member of the ship's company. He said that the admiral, from his earliest days in the Navy, had seen the cowardly practice of abusing and beating men who could not reply, their hands being tied, and that, his mind having been long schooled in cowardice, and he wearing the impregnable armour of the King's Commission, it now appeared quite natural to him to do so. I did not answer directly, meaning to ask your views first. I was reminded of it by hearing this boy revile a seaman and threaten him with a rope's end, when in a state of nature the man would have put him to silence. Even in the present unnatural conditions the sailor was sufficiently human and incautious to reply.
"Who was the midshipman?"
asked Jack, with strong displeasure.
"My dear, I am sorry that my face should look at all like an informer's," said Stephen. "But tell me now, how can I best confound Professor Graham?"
"Why, as to that,"
said Jack, blowing on his coffee cup and staring out of the stern window at the harbour.
"As to that, if you do not choose to call him a pragmatical clinch-poop and kick his breech, which you might think ungenteel, perhaps you could tell him to judge the pudding by its fruit."
You mean, prove the tree by its eating.
No, no, Stephen, you are quite out. Eating a tree would prove nothing. And then you might ask him, had he ever seen many poltroons in the Navy?
I am not quite sure what you mean by poltroons.
You might describe them as something that cannot be attempted to be tolerated in the Navy. Like wombats, he added, with a sudden recollection of the creatures Stephen had brought aboard an earlier command. Mean-spirited, worthless wretches. Cowards, to put it in a word.
You are unjust to wombats, Jack, and you are unjust to my three-toed sloth. Such illiberal reflections. But leaving wombats to one side, and confining ourselves to your poltroons, Graham might reply that he had seen a good many bullies in the Navy, and for him perhaps the two are much the same.
But they ain't, you know. They ain't the same thing at all. I thought they were once when I was a youngster in the Queen, and I stood up to a tyrannical brute, quite sure he would prove a barnyard cock and turn shy. Lord, how he did bang me up and down, laughing heartily at the recollection, and when I could no longer hear or see or keep my feet, he stood over me with a cobbing board.
For some minutes he had been watching a remote whirl of activity at the foot of the nearer castle, between the gatehouse and the shore, and now he broke off to say,
"They are launching a boat at last. A caique, with an awning."
He reached for his telescope.
"Yes, it is something official. I see an old gentleman with a beard being lifted in by two blackamoors. Killick, pass the word for Professor Graham. Tell Mr. Gill with my compliments that he is to be brought down by both master's mates together. Lord, what a set of lubbers," nodding towards the distant boat. "They have fouled a tree trunk. Now they have jibed, God help them. There will be plenty of time before we have to put on our coats."
This was the opinion of the quarter-deck as well. All those officers who were not on duty went back to their game of shove-groat in the gun-room. A great competition had been going on since Malta, and although the prize of 12 and 6 pence seemed trifling since the capture of the Bonhomme Richard, they still played with the greatest eagerness. As careless of the glorious sky, the perfect sea, the spectacular Ionian shore, and even of Pyrrhus and the Dalmatian pelicans, as they had been in some sunless convoy far out in the dazzling German ocean. Pullings glanced at his perfect decks, the white-gloved side-boys and the new covered man-ropes ready to bring the visitor aboard, the powdered and pipe-clayed marines prepared to stamp and clash by way of martial compliment, the boatswain and his mates waiting with their shining silver calls, and then hurried below himself to shove a groat, emerging only when the caique was within hailing distance. On deck, Gil, the officer of the watch, had everything well in hand. In the cabin below, Killick had arranged cushions in the oriental manner under Professor Graham's direction, and had lit the hubble-bubble laid in for the purpose at Valletta. Tobacco smoke rose from the cabin skylight, and the afterguard breathed it in greedily. The caique upset all natural calculations by suddenly darting round to the larboard main chains at the last moment, but the navy, accustomed to the wild vagaries of foreigners, dealt with the situation directly, facing about and providing a mirror image of the proper ceremonies, bringing the old gentleman aboard without a feather of the splendid aigrette in his turban being ruffled. He was led to the cabin, where Jack welcomed him, Graham acting as the interpreter. His only function was to invite Captain Aubrey to dine with the Bay, and to apologise for the lateness of the invitation. The Bay had been hunting in the marshes, and the news of the frigate's arrival had not reached him for a great while. He was desolated. He lay in ashes.
"What was the Bay hunting?" asked Jack,
who was interested in these things, and who, in any case, felt that some polite conversation might compensate for Killick's lukewarm version of sherbet and the plain navy twist in the hubble-bubble, neither of which seemed quite to the company's taste.
"Jews," said Graham, relaying the question and the answer.
"Pray ask the effendi whether the pelicans nest here," said Stephen, after the slightest pause. "I am aware that the Turks have a great kindness for the stork, and never molest her. Perhaps their humanity may extend to the pelican, there being a superficial resemblance."
"I beg your pardon, sir," said Pullings, coming in, "but the caique has sunk alongside. We have made it fast to the ties, head and stern, and the crew are aboard us."
"Very good, Mr. Pullings. I dare say they would like something to eat. Anything but swine's flesh, you know. Tell them no porco, pa porco. And let the barge be lowered down. I'm going ashore. Mr. Graham, please convey the sad news to the effendi and tell him our carpenters will probably be able to repair the damage."
The old gentleman did not seem much moved. He said that it was clearly God's will, and that he, for his part, had never put to sea without a disaster of some kind. Indeed, the contrary would surprise him.
"Then let us hope that the offender will be surprised on his return voyage," said Jack, "for it is clear he must make it in my barge." Thursday, at sea. So I took the old gentleman ashore, telling my bargemen to row dry, and as luck would have it, we shipped not a drop all the way, wrote Jack in his letter home. Though navigation in that choked-up harbour, with whole trees aground or floating, was neither beer nor yet skittles. But, however, Bondon knew that our honour depended on it, and he brought us alongside the jetty in great style. There I was pleased to see that they had spread out a perfectly beautiful blue carpet with a close pattern of rosy flowers, just the size to fit the breakfast parlour at home. Standing in the middle of it was Ismail Bey, the ruler of these parts, who welcomed me very civilly and led me to an uncommon fine horse, a bright bay stallion of rather better than 16 hands, to carry me the 300 yards into the castle. We passed through several courts, and in the last, which was full of orange trees trimmed neat, they had spread an awning and laid the table, a precious short-legged table, I may say, but since there were no chairs, only cushions raised on a low bench, it was just as well. And a pleasant thing was that through an empty gun embrasure opposite my place, I could see the dear surprise, exactly framed. We sat down, 6, the Bey and I, his vizier, and Professor Graham, and his astrologer with Stephen. The Bulbuljibashi, the keeper of the nightingales, and the Tornajibashi, the keeper of the cranes, had been brought to tell Stephen about pelicans, but they were not admitted to the table. We had no plates, or knives, or forks, though we each had a tortoise-shell spoon, and dinner was not served quite in our way either, there being no removes, but dishes following one another separately, to the number of 36, not counting the sweetmeats. Each came in to the sound of kettle-drums, brought by black men who put them down on a monstrous fine gold salver, nestling in an embroidered cushion in the middle of the table, Then we all reached out and took lumps with our fingers, unless it was very soft, and we used our spoons. One of the dishes was a roasted lamb with a pudding of bright yellow rice in its belly, and the bay seized it by the legs, tearing it very neatly to pieces for us. Graham was a great help, keeping up a fine flow of talk in Turkish, and telling us how to behave. He would have laughed to hear him say, every so often, and without looking at Stephen, "Feed the keeper of the nightingales, feed the keeper of the cranes," and Stephen would gravely put a piece into the waiting mouth behind. And sometimes he would say, in Killick's very words, "Captain A, your sleeve is in your dinner," and I am afraid it often was, a uniform coat not being designed for plunging wrist deep into a common dish. But apart from that, it was a forbiddingly grave and solemn meal, with scarcely a smile from start to finish. We drank only water until the end, when we reached coffee, which was poured into odd little china cups without handles, that stood in gold stands all set with diamonds and rubies and emeralds. Mine was all emeralds, and I was incautious enough to admire it. Ismail at once ordered it to be put up in a box and carried to the barge, and it was only Graham's firmly and repeatedly stating that for people of our nation this was a most inauspicious day for giving or receiving presents that saved the situation, for indeed it would never have done to lay myself under an obligation to the Bey, although he is in so much favour with our embassy in Constantinople, and although he certainly has smooth, obliging, caressing manners, I found him a disagreeably oily gentleman, not my idea of a Turk at all. And indeed Graham tells me that he is the grandson of a Greek apostate, while his mother was Egyptian. And it would not have answered at the end of the feast when most of the company was dismissed and we came to talk about the real point of our meeting. I will not trouble you with the details of our negotiations, but will only observe that although my profession requires me to suffer for my king and country, the agony of sitting cross-legged with one's breeches buckles grinding into one's very bone is, after the first 3 hours, far, far beyond the call of duty. In any case, I must resume our conversation for the Commander-in-Chief, and to write it out twice would be tedious indeed, particularly as it was so unsatisfactory. This was only the second instalment of a new letter, since he had posted the last in Malta, and he ran over it from the beginning. The extraordinary luck of having surprise, with a hand-picked crew, if only for this single cruise. The delightful little prize. Not a floating Golconda, not a Santa Brigida, not a capture that would do away with all the difficulties at home, but at least one that would give him room to turn around. And Sophie was to buy herself a new pelisse, a fine new tippet, Babington and the Grecian women, the noble coastline of Epirus. And he felt a certain twinge as he reread the lines in which he desired his daughters to find out Epirus on the map, and his son to read about Pyrrhus in Gregory's Polite Education.
"For it would be a great shame, was George to be found ignorant of Pyrrhus when he grew up."
Jack had never been a hypocrite until he became a father, and even now it did not come easy. Then he considered the paper he was to write, the memorandum of his conversation with Ismail Bey. The conclusion was plain enough. If the British guns were to be paid for by effective action against the French in Marga, Jack thought he could take them to a better market. Ismail seemed to him, and to his advisers, much more a politician than a warrior. He had no coherent military plan for taking Kutali, still less Marga, but seemed to think that the town must necessarily fall into his hands as soon as he had the cannon. Nor could he be brought to state the exact number of troops he would bring to the two operations. There would be a great many, far more than would be needed. He would have been delighted to show them, parading in the square, but 2 regiments and most of his best officers were away, putting down rebels in the north, while thousands of men were dispersed along the frontiers. But if Captain Aubrey would give him a little notice before he next came to Mezentero, there would be a magnificent review. Captain Aubrey would see a splendid body of men devoted to the British cause, burning to see the downfall of the French and perfectly equipped, except in the article of guns. Much of this sounded false, and all the falser for coming over in translation, separated from the significant looks and gestures that accompanied the original words. One of Jack's few certainties was that the Bey's notion of urgency, and even of time itself, was quite unlike his own. But by far the greater part of Ismail's discourse was concerned with his excellent relations with the British Embassy and with the characters of Mustafa and Sayahan, his rivals for the possession of Kutali. They were a sad pair, it seemed, in whom wickedness and greed struggled with ineptitude and cowardice for the mastery. They would, of course, endeavour to deceive Captain Aubrey, but Captain Aubrey would instantly perceive that the first was nothing but an illiterate corsair, scarcely better than a pirate, a person whose word no man relied on, while the second was a man of doubtful loyalty to the Sultan, completely under the influence of the notorious Ali Pasha of Yanini, and as impotent in the field of battle as he was in the harem, and both were devoted to Napoleon. Graham had warned him of the slowness of Oriental negotiation and of the different standards of acceptable duplicity. He had also said that Ismail's vizier, coming to ask what present Captain Aubrey would expect for his good offices in this affair, had offered the professor a personal commission of 840 piastres for each gun delivered. It was not an encouraging beginning, and perhaps the other beys would be much the same. It was not impossible that the embassy was right, and that Ismail was the depressing best of the bunch.
"Come in," he said in a low, dispirited voice,
and Elphinstone, a midshipman, walked in, trim and shining.
"Good morning, sir," he said. "You wish to see me?"
"Oh, Mr. Elphinstone, yes. You have three men down in the defaulters list, two are trifling cases, and five water grog for a couple of days will deal with them, but you bring Davis up on a serious charge, a flogging charge. If nobody speaks up for him, and if he cannot convincingly deny it, I must give him at least a dozen, though I very much dislike seeing men beaten. Do you like seeing men beaten?"
"Oh, no, sir. But is it not necessary for discipline?"
"Some people think so, and with some men perhaps it is. But I have known commanders go a year and more without any flogging, taught commanders of crack ships."
"Davis answered, sir. He answered very rudely when I told him to strop the block again. Said something about me still shitting yellow, which made the others laugh."
"Davis is a special case. He is a little odd, and he has always been allowed rather more leeway than the others. He was at sea long before you were born, and although he is still not very good at stropping a block nor serving a cable, he has other seaman-like qualities that will no doubt occur to your mind. He is enormously strong, for one thing. He is always the first to board, and he is a most terrifying sight on the enemy's deck. Mad bulls ain't in it. But I was forgetting. You have yet to see that kind of service." "That is all I have to say for the moment, Mr. Elphinstone. Good day to you. Pray give my steward a hail as you go by."
"It ain't no bleeding good, sir," said Killick,
in an angry whine, coming in with Jack's best coat over his arm.
"This nasty foreign mess will not come out, not if it's ever so. And now I've tried to cover it with saffron over the gold lace, it looks even worse. Time and time again I've said your sleeves in your dinner, sir, when it was only beef and pudding or drowned baby or the like, and that's been bad enough. But this here foreign mess, why?"
"Come, Killick, pipe down and give me my coat," said Jack. "There is not a moment to be lost."
"On your own head be it," said Killick,
helping him into the heavy full-dress coat, and he added something mutinous about laughing stock under his breath. Yet no very great degree of mirth greeted Captain Aubrey when he stepped onto his quarter-deck. This was a Wednesday, and at six bells in the forenoon watch on Wednesdays it was customary for all hands to be piped aft to witness punishment, a solemn occasion. Six bells struck. All the officers and young gentlemen were present, all in uniform. The grating was rigged, and the boatswain's mates stood by it, prepared to seize up any guilty man at the captain's word and flog him with the cat-o'-nine-tails that Mr. Holler had ready in its baize bag. The cat was not needed for the earlier defaulters. They were all mild cases of profane oaths, cursings, execrations, reproachful and provoking speeches or gestures, of uncleanliness or of drunkenness, and they were dealt with by suspension or dilution of grog or by extra duties. But when Davis's name was called, and his offence made known and admitted, or at least not denied, the boatswain began untying the baize bag's strings.
"This is a damned bad state of affairs, Davis," said Jack. "There you are, a man rated able, he's 20 years and more, answering an officer. You must have heard the articles read out some hundreds of times, and yet there you are, answering an officer. Mr. Ward, let us hear number 22, the second part."
"The 22nd article of war, sir. The second part," said the clerk, and he continued in a hieratic boom. If any mariner or other person in the fleet shall presume to quarrel with any of his superior officers, being in the execution of his office, or shall disobey any lawful command of any of his superior officers, every such person being convicted of any such offence by the sentence of a court-martial shall suffer death.
Here he paused and repeated,
"Shall suffer death,"
before going on in a perfunctory manner,
"or such other punishment as shall, according to the nature and degree of his offence, be inflicted on him by the sentence of a court-martial."
"There you are,"
said Jack, looking at Davis, who looked steadily at the deck.
"How can you hope to escape flogging? Have you anything to say for yourself?"
Davis made no reply, but began to take off his shirt.
"Has anyone else anything to say for him, then?"
"If you please, sir,"
said Elphinstone, taking off the cocked hat he had put on for the occasion. "He is in my division, and has always been diligent and attentive hitherto, obedient to command and respectful." At this, one of Davis's messmates, out of sight in the throng, burst out in a coarse hoot of laughter. But Elphinstone, blushing painfully, went on,
"I believe it was only a temporary lapse, sir, and should like to beg him off his punishment."
"Come, that is handsomely put," said Jack. "Do you hear, Davis? Mr. Elphinstone begs you off your flogging."
He then delivered a particularly dreary homily on right and wrong, whose only merit was that it was fairly short, and that it made him smile within. He was smiling openly when Stephen walked in, looking shrewish. Like many large, florid, good-natured men, Jack Aubrey was afflicted with an undue proportion of small, pale, meagre friends of a shrewish turn. One of his earliest shipmates and closest acquaintances, Heneage Dundas, had already earned himself the name of Vinegar Joe throughout the service. Jack's steward was a confirmed nagger, and at times even Sophie. He was therefore peculiarly sensitive to the quality of shrewishness, and even before Stephen opened his mouth, Jack knew that he was about to say something disagreeable.
"I only ask for information," he said, "and without the least personal bearing. But tell me, when captains set themselves up as judges and lay down the moral as well as the military law, extolling virtues that they rarely, if ever, practice, do they often feel the spiritual squalor of their conduct?"
"I dare say they do," said Jack, smiling still. "I know I have often wondered that I was not struck down by 11 flash. But there you are. No ship carries a man rated spotless Christian hero, so the captain has to do what he can for the sake of discipline."
"I see," said Stephen. "So it is not for the sake of exalting him in his own opinion, it is not for the sake of airing his own views before an audience that dare not stir or disagree, it is not for the deeply discreditable, nay, wicked pleasure of exercising his almost unlimited power, nor is it that our gentleman is unaware of the true nature of his act. No, no, it is all for discipline, for the country's good. Very well. I am content."
He sniffed and went on.
"Pray, what is this I hear about passing for a gentleman?"
With a flash of insight, Jack perceived that Stephen had been talking to Driver, the new marine officer they had shipped at Malta, a great admirer of kings, titles of honour, ancient families, coats of arms, hereditary office, and privilege in general.
"Well," he said, "you know what we mean by passing for lieutenant. When a mid has served his 6 years, he attends the board with his certificates and his logs. The captains present examine him, and if they find he understands his profession, he passes for lieutenant."
"Sure, I have heard of it many, many times, and I remember poor Babington's trembling anxiety, but I calmed his spirits with 3 drops of the essence of hellebore on a piece of sugar, and he passed with sailing colours."
"Flying colours."
"Let us not be pedantical, for all love."
"But," said Jack, "so many have passed since the beginning of the war, and so many have been made lieutenants, that now there are more on the list than there can be employment for, let alone promotion. So some years ago men of no particular family found they were being left on shore. They had not passed for gentlemen, and they did not possess the friends or connections that could make interest for them, though sometimes they were capital seamen. Tom Pullings could not find a ship for a great while, and of course no ship, no promotion. I did my best, naturally, but I was away much of the time, and anyhow one scheme after another came to nothing. Just before they gave me the Worcester, I took him to dine at Slaughter's, with Rowlands of the Hebe, who had lost a lieutenant overboard. They got along well enough, but afterwards Rowlands told me he did not choose to have anyone on his quarter-deck who did not say Balcony, and unfortunately poor Tom had said Balcony. It is the old story of the gentleman captains and the tarpaulins all over again.
What is your view of the matter?
I have no very clear view. There are so many factors, and so much depends on what you mean by gentleman. But suppose it is no more than the usual notion of someone whose family has had a certain amount of money for two or three generations, someone with reasonably good manners and at least a scrape of education. Why then, seamanship being equal, I should rather have the gentleman than not, partly because it is easier for the officers to live together if they have roughly the same ideas of behaviour, but even more because the foremost hands value birth so highly, perhaps much more highly than they should.
Your ideal is a gentleman who is also a seaman?
I suppose so. But that would exclude Cook and many other men of the very first rate. As a rough rule, it might answer for the common run, but it seems to me that your really good sea officer is always an exceptional being, and one that ordinary rules scarcely apply to. Tom Pullings, for example. He may not be another Howe or Nelson, but I am quite certain he would make a far better captain than most. We do not often have occasion to talk of balconies at sea. I have tried to get him made again and again, as you know very well, but pushing don't always answer, and too much may do harm. Look at this, he said, passing a letter from among the papers on his open desk.
Sir, read Stephen, the board, not having considered the service alluded to in your letter of the 14th, performed under the direction of Lieutenant Pullings, of the description that entitles him to promotion, I must confess my surprise at the manner in which you have thought fit to address me on the subject of it. Very sincerely, your humble servant, Melville.
That was years ago, said Jack, the cutting out of the Rosa. But things are no better now. Rather worse, indeed, with my old father cutting his capers in the Commons and shedding such a blight on any recommendation of mine. And Tom's only hope is a successful action. That is why we were so very disappointed when Emeriao slipped away, and why I do so very much hope that this next Turk, this Mustafa, may show more promise than the last. Turning the French out of Marga will almost certainly count as a frigate action, with a step for the first lieutenant. With this breeze we should reach Caria tomorrow, and form some notion of the Capitan Bay.
In the event, they formed their notion of him a good deal earlier. The Surprise was standing northward, surrounded by a cloud of her own making, when the lookout gave news of two ships on the starboard quarter, two ships under the land. He would have given the news sooner if he had not been watching the competition between the watches with such passionate interest, and now his hail had an anxious quality, for the ships were already hull up, and this was one of the offences that Captain Aubrey rarely overlooked. By way of covering up, he added details.
Turkish frigate coming up hand over hand, stunsails aloft and alow. T'other may be a 20-gun ship. Turk likewise, all plain sail. Holds her course under the land. Very hard to see.
The starboard watch had just shattered a floating cask at 400 yards, at the end of an exercise in which they had attained a thoroughly satisfactory rate of accurate fire. Jack said,
"How's your guns? Starboards win by 2 points. A creditable exercise, Mr. Pullings."
Then walking to the taffrail, he directed his telescope at the newcomer and her distant consort. Graham and Stephen were standing by the stern lantern, and to them he said with a smile,
"We are in luck. Here we have the whole Turkish navy this side of the archipelago. That is the Torgud coming up, and the Kitabi over there under the land, and I make no doubt the Capitan Bey is aboard the frigate."
Raising his voice, he gave the order that brought the Surprise close to the wind on the starboard tack, steering a course that would cross the Torgud's bows. Jack moved up to the forecastle as the ship turned and studied the Turk intently. She was built in the European manner, probably in a French or Venetian yard, and although the people on her deck wore turbans or scarlet skull-caps, she was sailed in the European manner. Pretty well handled, far better than her lumpish consort over the way, who was most shamefully brought by the lee, rounding a headland just as he turned his glass on her. The Torgud threw a fine bow-wave under her press of sail. She was obviously quite fast when going large, and as the Surprise was always happy on a bowline, the two frigates came together at a spanking pace. For a while they were almost head-on, but then the angle opened as the Torgud altered course to swing wide and cross the Surprise's wake. She turned with a fine gleam of brass cannon all along her side, and now for the first time Jack could really see what she was like. She was rather heavier than the Surprise, and she mounted another pair of guns. Damned odd gun ports amidships, too, but he had the impression that they overpressed her. that she would not handle easy and that she might be slack in stays. From the churning of her wake, she must carry an uncommon strong weather helm. But there was little time for staring. "Sir," said Puddings, "I believe they mean to come under our stern."
"Come, that is civil," said Jack. "Professor Graham, do you understand the Turkish naval etiquette?"
"No, sir, I do not," said Graham. "But in general, they follow the French."
"Silly dogs," said Jack. "However, he means to be polite. Mr. Borrell, stand by to give him 13 guns the moment his jib comes in."
The Turkish frigate ran down, put her helm hard over and rounded to, lying there under the Surprise's lee. It was pretty well done, scarcely navy fashion. The taking in of the stunsails was far too ragged for that, and there was a sad want of coordination in the rising of the tacks, a general raggedness. But few merchantmen or privateers could have beat the Torgud's performance. And none could have outdone her in briskness of lowering a boat. It splashed down with an almighty thump from her quarter-davits, and its crew tumbled over the rail in a most surprising fashion, followed almost as rapidly by men in robes, presumably officers. Jack had expected a long, shouted exchange of civilities from ship to ship, but he had hardly had time to return to the quarter-deck before the Turkish boat was halfway across. Its bargemen were not elegantly dressed. One had nothing more than a torn pair of calico drawers, nor did they row pretty, but from their urgency and concentrated effort they might have been pulling for a prize. And facing the rowers, acting as his own coxswain, sat a man in a purple turban, a red beard down to his swelling belly, and purple baggy trousers. So big a man, it was a wonder the boat was not grossly by the stern. Jack clapped on the cocked hat that Killick silently passed him, glanced fore and aft, and saw that Pullings, quicker-witted than his commander, had already turned out the marines and laid on a proper reception. Then he heard the boat hook on, and looking over the rail, he saw the big man reach for the man-ropes. The Surprise gave a distinct heel as he grasped them, and come running up the side as nimbly as a boy. Reaching the quarter-deck, he put his hand to his forehead, then to his heart, bowing with a magnificence that might have seemed excessive in a smaller man. But Mustafa was huge in person and in presence. Though not quite as tall as Jack, he was broader by far, and his vast purple Turkish trousers made his bulk seem even greater.
"Mustafa, Capitan Bey,"
he said in a resounding boom, and the wispy officer who had followed him said the same, adding in Greek and something like English,
"Commander of the Grand Turk's ships in these waters, and Lord of Caria."
"Welcome aboard, sir," said Jack, stepping forward with his hand held out. "Professor Graham, pray tell the gentlemen they are welcome aboard, and suggest that we should take coffee in the cabin." "So you speak Turkish," said Mustafa, gently patting Graham's cheek. "Very good, very good. Then Ulusan can go back to the boat." "Would he not like to take some refreshment in the gunroom?" asked Jack, seeing Ulusan bow and turn away.
"The Capitan B says he might be tempted to drink wine and even spirits, forbidden to Mussulmans," said Graham. "He is better in the boat."
In the cabin, Jack was pleased to find that the Capitan Bey could smile and even laugh. The extreme gravity of his hosts at Mezenterran had weighed upon his spirits, making an already serious matter positively funereal. Furthermore, Ismail and his advisers had always looked at the table when addressing him, a part of Turkish manners, perhaps, but disconcerting. And now, with Mustafa's shrewd, knowing, often amused eye fixed steadily on his, he felt much more at home. They were curious orange-yellow eyes, and they looked small in that huge face, smaller still when Mustafa smiled. The red-dyed beard would part, showing a broad gleam of teeth, and the eyes would almost vanish in the luxuriant, bristling hair. This happened more and more often as the afternoon wore on, and it was found that Mustafa could quite easily be tempted to drink wine and even spirits. They had been for a tour of the frigate, during which it had become evident that Mustafa, though a judge of a ship, was even more devoted to a gun. He was fascinated by the improvements that Jack had borrowed from Philip Broke of the Shannon, at least for his chasers, and he fairly gloated over the heavy carronades, the genuine smashers that lined the Surprise's quarter-deck. For his ideal engagement was a furious battery at ever-diminishing range, followed by boarding.
"I love guns," he said when they were back in the cabin, smoking the hubble-bubble and drinking punch. They are not to be had now that Venice is gone, and I need all I can get to take Cotali. I am delighted you have brought me so many. And I should be delighted to give them to a fellow seaman, said Jack, smiling. But they are my master's guns, and I must deliver them to the ally best suited for helping us to turn the French out of Marga. As I believe you know, two other gentlemen have proposed their services, and in justice I must hear what all those concerned may have to say. I can tell you what Ismail has said, cried Mustafa. He has said that I am an illiterate corsair, hand in glove with the French, not to be trusted for a moment. And Siam will tell you I am in league with Ali Pasha, plotting to rebel against the Sultan. Not to be trusted for a moment! Ha ha ha! But neither can say I did not conquer Djerba and pacify the Morea in a 2 years' campaign. 100 towns and villages in flames! And neither can be of the least use in helping you to turn the French out of Marga. Ismail is a mere Egyptian eunuch, terrified by the sound and sight of battle, and Sayahan is too old for anything like war. Negotiation is his line, and that will never answer with the French. Whereas once I hold Kotali, the thing is done. We attack from land and sea, while at the same moment all the Mussulmans in the town rise up. Nothing can withstand the shock, believe me, Captain. Nothing can withstand the shock. Come and look at my ship. You will see what she is capable of. You will see what kind of men I have aboard.
Hairy buggers, muttered Bondon, gazing up the side as his captain went aboard the Torgut, welcomed by the clash of cymbals. And by this he meant not only bearded, but savage, fierce, dark, passionate, rough, fiery, vicious, and tigerish. Jack had much the same impression, and he had more of a right to it since he saw the whole crew, the surprisingly numerous crew. They all had a certain family look, although they were of many different races and colours, from shining black to the sour cheese grey of Bessarabians. They were presumably united by religion, certainly by their awe of the Capitan Bey. Defaulters in the Torgud were cut up for bait, and they visibly trembled before him. The officers all appeared to be Turks, and judging from the knowledgeable zeal with which they showed their great guns and small arms, they understood the fighting part of their profession, while the way the ship had rounded served to prove that at least some of them were competent seamen. Yet none seemed to have the slightest notion of order, discipline, or cleanliness, except as far as the guns were concerned. These were all brass, and they all gleamed nobly in the declining sun. Apart from that, the Torgud appeared to possess no first lieutenant, no boatswain, no captain of the sweepers. The rigging was knotted rather than spliced when repair was needed. The planking of the deck could not be seen at all for dirt, and between the guns lay little heaps of human excrement. Yet in spite of this, the Torgud was evidently a formidable vessel, not unlike a larger, much more dangerous version of the pirate ships Jack had seen in the West Indies. He had little time for reflection, however, because, as Mustafa showed his ship, he also expounded his plan of attack on Kutali, explained it with an exuberant vitality that called for the closest attention, particularly as Graham was sometimes at a loss for a sea term. In essence, the attack was to be a bombardment by shallow-draft gunboats armed with the cannon Jack would supply, and this would be followed by a general assault. Mustafa had nearly 40 suitable caiques up and down the coast. They would open half a dozen breaches in the wall, and his men would carry the place by storm. He looked attentively at Jack. But Jack, having nothing to say about an attack on a town whose shore he did not know and whose defenders and fortifications he had never seen, merely bent his head politely. In any case, much of his mind was taken up by the extraordinary half-seen spectacle of the midship's cannon. The middle gun in the long row of brass 18-pounders seemed to tower over its fellows in the strangest way. But its uncommonly large port lid was shut at the moment, and the sailmaker had spread his work over much of its bulk.
"This is my heart's delight," said Mustafa, waving the canvas away.
And to his astonishment Jack beheld a 36-pounder, an unheard-of, preposterous weapon for a frigate. Even a first-rate line-of-battle ship carried no more than 32-pounders, and those only on the lowest tier, and so massive that it dwarfed its neighbours. and over against it, on the larboard side, there was its fellow, its necessary counterpoise.
"I have never seen such a beautiful gun!"
cried Jack, examining the dolphins that twined round the King of Portugal's arms and the well-worn touch-hole.
"But do you indeed find they answer the weight and the confusion?"
he asked, looking keenly at the reinforced deck and side and the triple ring-bolts. And until they reached the cabin, they discussed the advantages and disadvantages of the arrangement, the inconvenience of different calibres on the same deck, the extra weight so high in the ship, and its effect on her roll in heavy weather, as opposed to the crippling effect of 36-pound shot hitting the enemy at a distance. In the cabin itself, a singularly gorgeous room hung with crimson damask, the appearance of coffee broke the thread. And in any case it was evident that Jack was about to leave. He could not be persuaded to stay any longer, nor to visit the nearby port of Caria, because he had a rendezvous with his consort, the Dryad. This being established, Mustafa went over his plan of attack again, with a reasonably convincing account of the forces at his disposal, and once again he stated his opinion of Sayahan Bey and Ismail. Sayahan's chief crime, apart from greed and avarice, was age, cold-blooded, incompetent age, and Jack had the impression that although Mustafa would certainly expel Sayahan from Kutali if he could, perhaps killing him in the process, he did not really dislike him. With Ismail, it was quite a different matter. Here there were detailed, persuasive charges of faithlessness, hypocrisy, and disloyalty. Mustafa's voice grew even stronger, his eye more terrible. He called upon God to curse his children's children if ever he allowed that vile, unmanly traitor to get the better of him. Jack had seen some passionate men, but none who seemed to swell so much, nor whose great clenched fist trembled so with rage, none whose eyes became more suffused with red. Clearly there was something very much more than competition for the disputed town between Mustafa and Ismail, though, on the other hand, there was no doubt that Mustafa was also extremely eager to possess Kutali. The Capitan Bey boomed, organ-toned, and in the barge alongside, Bondon said, "How their skipper does carry on, to be sure, like a bull in a barn." At this, the port lid of the starboard 36-pounder opened, and a hairy, turbaned face peered out. "Well, you'll know me again, mate," observed Bondon, having been stared at for a full unwinking minute.
"Barrett Bondon," said the hairy face, "you don't remember me."
"I can't say as how I do, mate, behind all them whiskers."
"Ezekiel Edwards, quarter gunner in Isis when you was captain of the foretop. Zeke Edwards, ran when we was off of Tiberoon."
"Zeke Edwards?" said Bondon, nodding his head.
"Yes."
"Then, what are you doing in this barkie? Was you took? Are you a prisoner?"
"No, which I belong to her, gunner's mate."
Bondon considered him for a moment and said,
"So you turned Turk and grew a full set and clapped a pudding cloth round your head?"
"That's right, mate, being I never was brought up religious and being I was circumcised already, any gate."
The other bargemen had been gazing steadily at Edwards with their mouths open. They now closed them and stared with wooden disapproval out to sea, but he had spoken with such an awkward, urgent, pleading tone, as though longing beyond expression to hear and utter Christian sounds, that Bondon replied. Rather severely he asked what Edwards was doing with that 36-pounder, what a 36-pounder was doing in a frigate, for Christ's sake, a long 36-pounder. This released a flood of words, a stumbling, confidential rush, with scraps of Greek and Turkish and lingua franca mixed with the burring West Country English, all delivered into Bondon's disapproving, half-averted ear.
The guns were from Corfu, from the French general in Corfu,
and he had let the skipper have them because why? Because they was Portuguese, and did not take the French 36-pound ball, nor any other bloody ball now made, that was why. But the Capitan Bey did not care for that. He had marble round shot made by the Greeks in the island of Paros, smooth as glass. The trouble was, they often cracked if not stowed very careful, and then they cost a mint of money. You could not blaze away with half a dozen rounds just to keep your hand in. You could not fling marble balls about, not marble balls at 19 piastres apiece.
"Marble balls?" said Bondon, obscurely feeling some reflection upon the surprise and her plain iron round shot. "Marble balls, my arse."
"'I never seen such a filthy mud scow as this here in all my life,'
remarked Bao Or, spitting to leeward.
"'Don't they never wash down the heads?'
Edwards instantly grasped the implication, and he cried out very humbly that he had not meant to top it the knob, nor to come it the heavy. He did not go for to make them believe the shot-locker was crammed with marble balls. No, no, there was not but five for the starboard gun and four for t'other, one of them chipped. More he could not say, for now cymbals clashed, shrill drums beat, and conches brayed loud as Captain Aubrey made his farewells and stepped down into the barge with Professor Graham, sitting thoughtful and silent as they were rowed back in the twilight. Thoughtful and silent again on this quarter-deck at dawn, with Marga almost vanishing on the starboard quarter. He levelled his telescope, took a last look at the rock-built citadel, the great Venetian mole, and resumed his pacing. Silent, partly because it had long been his habit to go up and down the windward side of whatever vessel he commanded, as long as he could without disturbing the ship's routine, and partly because neither of his advisers was awake, they having discussed Mustafa and Ismail well into the middle watch. Thoughtful, because although Mustafa was a fine fellow in some ways, he was not likely to show much zeal in turning the French out of Marga if he was on such friendly terms with General Donzelot in Corfu. Bondon's report had reached him through Killick with his first cup of coffee, and then Bondon had confirmed it himself. As he turned, his eye caught the flash of a sail in the offing, far beyond the Dryad. She had joined at nightfall, and she was now keeping her station abreast of the Surprise, they being spread out in the faint hope of snapping up some vessel bound for the French in Corfu, or better still, one from the French in Corfu to their friends in Marga. Automatically he pointed his telescope, but realizing that he could not possibly spare the time to chase anything at such a distance, it was only a little trabacolo in any case, he shifted his gaze to the Dryad, and found himself looking straight at Babington, who was leaning on the quarter-rail with a very pretty young woman in a sort of pink, lacy garment. He was showing her something over the side, and they were both laughing very cheerfully. Jack clapped his glass, too. He remembered that Babington, coming aboard to report, had muttered something about giving a lift to a respectable Italian matron, an officer's widow from Cephalonia to Santa Mora, being compelled to keep her aboard, the wind not serving for Santa Mora, and he being so unwilling to delay Captain Aubrey at the rendezvous. A matron could, of course, be no more than 20, and a widow could perfectly well be cheerful, but it would not do. It really would not do. The next turn brought him face to face with something else that would not do. Young Williamson, the midshipman of the watch, was looking wretchedly peaked and ill again. The boy was not strong enough for a life at sea, and Jack would never have taken him if he had not been Dick Williamson's son. He had wanted no first voyages, no children who should not relieve the deck at 4 in the morning on an empty belly, and here he was, still answerable to their mothers for 2 of them at a time when he needed all his powers for infinitely more important problems than the moral and physical welfare of a pair of squeakers. He would invite the boy to breakfast, and at the same time beg Stephen to look at him. In any case, Stephen ought to be up by now. Cape Stavro was already looming on the starboard bow, and he must not miss the opening of Kutali Bay.
"Mr. Williamson,"
he called, and the boy gave a guilty start.
"Pray go down to Dr. Maturin's cabin, and if he is awake, tell him with my compliments that we are about to open Kutali Bay, which is reckoned a prodigious fine spectacle, and perhaps you would give us the pleasure of your company at breakfast."
While he waited for Stephen, and a long wait it was, Dr. Maturin having ensured sleep at last by 4 successive doses, Jack watched the shore go by, a prodigious fine spectacle in itself, now that they were drawing in with the land, a steep-to shore of towering light-grey cliffs rising straight from deep water and backed by mountains, precipitous, jagged mountains reaching high up the sky with the early light cutting across them from a little south of east, so that they stood out clear, range after range of them, 7 deep, the vast forests green on the sunward side, the bald crags shining grey. Ordinarily, Jack disliked being near any coast at all. He was a blue-water sailor, one who liked plenty of sea-room under his lee, 50 leagues or so, but here he had 100 fathoms beneath his keel, within gunshot of the land, and in any case the weather had been unusually kind. It was now treating them to a t'gallant zephyr, a point or so before the beam, that might have been specially ordained to carry them round the cape and into the bay. but whether it would waft them eastwards again to Kutali was doubtful. It had a somewhat languishing, dying air, and perhaps they should be obliged to wait for the sea breeze to set in to complete their voyage round the great peninsula. In fact, the Zephyr dropped entirely while they were still at breakfast. But this was an unusually prolonged meal, and there had been time not only for the surprise to round the cape and reach the middle of the bay, but for Dr. Maturin to recover his humanity. He had begun the day in a very sullen, dogged, and unappreciative mood indeed, opposed to natural beauties of any kind. But now, led out, well-fed, well-coffered, to smoke his morning cigar and admire the view, he was perfectly ready to admit that he had seen few more glorious sights than Kutali and its setting. The water of the bay was gently rippled in some few places, but glass-smooth in others, and in the purest of these natural mirrors they could see the astonishing peaks that rose from the sea with a whole town at their feet. All this reversed, and superimposed upon the image stood ships and boats, most, as it were, suspended, hanging motionless, a few creeping across the surface with sweeps or sculls. The dead calm, the cloudless sky, the stillness of the ship, and perhaps this sense of being on or even in a looking-glass, gave an extraordinary impression of silence, and people spoke unnaturally low. The close-packed town itself had the appearance of a double cone, grey battlements, red roofs, white walls repeated in the mirror image, until a chance air destroyed the reflection. This did not affect the walls of the upper town or the citadel, but with its double vanishing, the lower town's ramparts suddenly shrank to half its height. It no longer looked very formidable, and Jack saw that Mustafa's plan of battering it with gunboats was perfectly feasible. Although at first sight Kutali looked compact, rising in one triangular mass from the sea up the mountainside, it was in fact built in three parts. The lowest straggled out on either side of the fortified harbour, and here the wall had been spread too far, too thin. It was vulnerable, and as far as Jack could see, looking steadily through his telescope, the defences of the middle town would not stand any very determined assault either. But, he reflected, looking up at the heavily fortified upper town, the Christian town with its church towers showing above the battlements, even a small battery of cannon up there, even 3 or 4 12-pounders well plied, would make the attack impossible by sinking the gunboats as they came within range. There was no need for massive fortifications below, so long as the sea and the lower ground was commanded by artillery. Mustafa swore that the Christians had only 2 guns, old and honeycombed, and some mangonels, but that even if they had 12 he should still carry out his attack on Sayahan, because the Christians would not interfere in a quarrel between Mussulmans, and that might very well be so, thought Jack, now surveying the harbour as a naval base, a fine, roomy naval base with fresh water just at hand, deep water repairing docks, and any amount of timber, capital Valona oak.
"That is the Christian town up there," said Graham at his side. "You will perceive that no mosque has been built within the walls. A mixed mercantile community occupies the middle town, and mariners, shipbuilders, and so on, the seashore. The Turks live mostly in the suburb to the right, on the far side of the stream, and you can make out the governor's kiosk beyond what I take to be the ruined temple of the Pelasgian Zeus. Yes, I see Sayhan's banner. He is an ally bey, the equivalent of a brigadier. He therefore displays a single horse-tail."
Stephen was about to say, "A galley is putting off from the strand." But as he, Jack, Graham, and Pullings were all standing on the forecastle, gazing steadily in that direction, he saved his breath.
13 guns for a brigadier, sir?" asked Pullings.
Jack paused, focused his telescope with the utmost care.
"That is no brigadier," he said at last. "No brigadier I have ever seen, one-tailed or two. I believe it is a Greek parson, the kind they call a pope in these parts."
The surprises reception of a pope, a square-topped, black-hooded Orthodox pope, was less certain than their reception of brigadiers, but they carried it off well enough, and in the cabin those chiefly concerned with his entertainment very soon lost their Sunday expressions when it appeared that Father Andros was not only the representative of the Christians of Kutali, but also one of the bey's political advisers, and his emissary on this occasion.
The Bey was unwell, and although he would be overjoyed to see Captain Aubrey as soon as he was recovered, the need for dispatch was so great that he had asked Father Andros to wait upon the captain with his best compliments, and to lay the position before him, at the same time conveying the Bey's specific requests and his corresponding propositions. By way of credentials, Father Andros passed Jack a beautifully written document with a seal to it, saying in an aside to Graham,
"I bring you the greetings of Osman the Smyrniot."
"Is he in Kutali?"
"No, he was called to Yanina, to Ali Pasha, the day you saw Ismail."
"This is a most elegant letter," said Jack, passing the document on to Graham. "But pray tell the gentleman that he could bring no better credentials than his cloth and his countenance."
It was clear that Killick shared his captain's favourable impression of Father Andros, who was indeed a fine, manly-looking priest, because at this point he brought in a decanter of Jack's very best Madeira, the kind with a yellow seal. Father Andros, too, could be tempted to drink wine, but even if it had been much later in the day, it would obviously have been no use offering him spirits. Nor was he much given to smiles or laughter. His business was too serious for either, and he laid it out in a direct, methodical, and, Jack would have sworn, reasonably candid way. Sayahan's claim to Kutali was perfectly justified by Turkish law and custom, and it would no doubt be vindicated by the Sultan's irade in the course of time. But Father Andros would not go into that. He would confine himself to the immediate practical issues. It was understood that the British Admiral wished to use Kutali as a base for his attack upon the French in Marga, and as a place of refuge and supply for his ships in the Ionian Sea, and that in exchange for the base he offered a certain number of cannon, providing these cannon were also used against the French. Marga could be attacked only from the heights behind the town, and to reach these heights one necessarily had to pass by Kutali, and at Kutali alone could Marga's aqueduct be cut. Both Ismail Bey and Mustafa would have to fight exceedingly hard for Kutali, because apart from his own troops, Sayahan would have the backing of the Christians, who were extremely unwilling to be ruled by either Mustafa or Ismail, both being not only notoriously rapacious, but also bigoted Mussulmans, while Mustafa, who was in practice very little removed from a common pirate, was odious to the whole mercantile class, the shipowners and the mariners, Mussulmans and Christians alike, so that in the unlikely event of a victory the winner's few surviving men would be of very little use against the French, even if Ismail or Mustafa ever kept his word and joined in the attack, which Father Andros begged leave to doubt extremely. It also followed that neither Ismail nor Mustafa could count on any support whatsoever from the Christians of Marga, an essential point if the attack were to succeed at once, rather than drag out in a long siege that would give the French party in Constantinople time to intervene. Most of the Margiots were Christian. Sayahan Bey, on the other hand, was already in possession of Kutali. He had continued the mild, almost imperceptible rule of the former Vali, leaving the Christians their own courts and the possession of the citadel. He was on such good terms with the various communities, the Albanians, Vlachs, and Greeks, that they had guaranteed him 680 fighting men, many of them Mirdite Gegs. Indeed, he was the ideal ally for the English admiral. His military reputation reposed on 23 distinct campaigns, two of them in Syria and Egypt, in conjunction with the British, whom he esteemed, against the French, whom he loathed. He was a true Turk, a man of his word. He was not a descendant of Egyptian slaves or Algerian renegades, nor a man who would receive the cannon and then discover fresh needs or reasons for declining to attack the French. He invited Captain Aubrey to come ashore to view his troops and to tour the city with Father Andros, seeing its strengths and its admitted weaknesses for himself.
"Come, he cannot say fairer than that," said Jack. "Killick, my barge!"
"This coast is familiar to you, I believe," said Stephen to Graham, as they walked up through the busy town behind Captain Aubrey and Father Andros.
"I have not been just here before," said Graham, "but I have visited Ragusa and Cataro, which are not unlike, and some of the inland parts."
"Then no doubt you can tell me what these cheerful souls in short white gathered petticoats and red caps and such a quantity of weapons may be."
"They are Tosks, southern Albanians. My good friend Ali Pasha is a Tosk. He is a Mussulman, of course, but many Tosks,
perhaps most in these parts, are Orthodox Christians. Observe the deference with which they treat this worthy priest."
It was quite true. As the worthy priest led the way with an elastic, bounding step up the steep, crowded central street, or rather flight of stairs, the people fell away on either hand, bowing, smiling, pushing mules, asses, and children against the wall.
"Yet not all are quite so respectful," remarked Stephen a little later. "The person in the doorway there, with the mustachios of the world and a pair of pistols and a curious sword and two daggers in his belt, the person in crimson pantaloons and a short gold-laced jacket, is secretly biting his thumb in a gesture of contempt or defiance."
"He is a keg from the north," said Graham. "Sad fellows, much given to murder and rapine. I dare say he is a Romanist or a Mussulman. The curious sword is a yatakan. Now there is a keg who is certainly a Romanist. The fellow in the long white tunic with a red sash and white trousers. Do not look too pointedly. They are very apt to take offence, and as you see, he carries a perfect arsenal. He is a Merdite, an entirely Catholic tribe of Gegs. There is a large colony of them in the neighbourhood, though their home is in the northern highlands."
"They must feel at home here, then," said Stephen. "This town is built for the chamois and her kind, or the true mountain Capricorn."
The street, growing somewhat steeper, turned abruptly to the left, so that now, as they climbed, the strong sun beat upon their backs. And still Father Andros strode on, his black robe billowing out behind as he pointed out the various quarters, Venetian, Greek, Jewish, Armenian, and Vlach, all separately fortified in the days of the Republic. Apart from a few hours in Malta and at Mezentarin, Jack had not set foot on land for months, and his boots were killing him. So was his uniform coat put on to review the troops in the Maidan far below, and so were his breeches, his sword belt, and his neckcloth. The younger Jack would have climbed on, blind and gasping, till he burst. Now, after a decent interval of suffering, the present Captain Aubrey cried,
"Hold hard! Hold hard for a moment! You will kill your allies!"
Andros led them to a square, with a fountain under an immense nettle tree with a smooth grey trunk, and as he sat recovering in the green shade, drinking ice-cold retsina brought from a nearby house, Jack mused upon his use of that word, allies. It was a busy square, with a market at its far end by the church, and people of half a dozen races walked to and fro across it, most of the men armed, many of the women veiled. They were all intensely curious, but all, even the children, remarkably discreet. Yet at one point Stephen noticed a tall, martial man leave a group of Catholic kegs and come deliberately towards them, twirling his moustache with a hand adorned with a magnificent amethyst. He had two silver-mounted pistols in the belt of what looked very like a cassock, and a musket, or perhaps a fowling-piece, no, a musket, over his shoulder, a pectoral cross showing beneath its butt. Stephen was aware of a tension, and he noticed that Andros and the stranger timed their salutes with the utmost exactness, so that neither was half a second before the other.
"This is the Catholic Bishop of Prizren, who accompanies part of his Merdite flock," said Father Andros.
Jack and Graham rose and bowed. Stephen kissed the bishop's ring, and they conversed in Latin for a while, the bishop being very urgent to know whether it was true that the King of England was about to be converted, and whether the British Admiral might be induced to guarantee the independence of the Republic of Kutali. Stephen could satisfy them on neither point, but they parted on the kindest terms, and it was observable that the morose kegs looked more favourably upon the party now that it was known that at least one member was of the right way of thinking. This was particularly evident when they reached the citadel, which at this time of day was guarded by the kegs alone, a proud, haughty, dark and sullen band that blossomed into smiling humanity when one of the many accompanying children told them the news. But neither children nor other followers were admitted beyond the gate, and beyond the gate Father Andros's lively flow of talk ceased entirely. His face was graver than ever as he led them up the winding path to the ultimate platform, a half-moon battery that took its rise in the living rock on either hand, curving out to dominate the sea, the lower town, and its approaches. As the path mounted, crossing and recrossing the precipitous rock face, Jack counted the embrasures up there, 21 of them, all filled, more than enough guns to deal with a powerful squadron if reasonably well handled. Yet at the last turning, at the last iron wicket, Father Andros hesitated.
"We are perfectly candid, as you see,"
he said, unlocking the gate at last.
"Sayahan Bey has repeatedly said that he relies entirely upon the honour of an English naval officer."
The remark was not well received.
"If he is so sure, he need scarcely say at once, let alone keep up a perpetual harping on the subject," reflected Jack.
And Stephen said, "This is a clumsy form of blackmail," to himself, while the whole tone of Graham's translation conveyed disapproval. Andros, however, was far too agitated to notice. He took them into the battery, and once the small group of gunners who manned it had stood clear, Jack saw the cause of his emotion. All the guns but three were made of painted wood, and of the others, two had had their trunnions beaten off so that they could not be pointed with any sort of accuracy, while the third, an archaic brass piece, had once been spiked, and the person who bored out its touch-hole had made a sad botch of it. Mustafa could bring in his gunboats at high noon if he chose, and batter away at the lower walls to his heart's content. There was nothing in Kutali to stop him.
"These two we use for firing salutes," said Andros, "to deceive the world in general. The third we dare not touch."
"Has the bay no field pieces?" asked Jack.
"Only one, and it throws no more than a 3-pound ball. He keeps it in his camp. If it were brought up here, people might suspect the real state of affairs."
Jack nodded, and leaning out over the parapet, he considered the possibility of splicing four cables an end and winching up cannon made fast to well-greased travellers directly from the shore. After all, an 18-pounder weighed no more than his bower anchors, and half a dozen would make this place perfectly impregnable. But getting even one or two up those impossible, narrow, twisting, ladder-like streets would be a labour of weeks. The holdfast, this end, and of course the prodigious tension would be the main difficulties, but they would deal with that problem when they came to it. Tom Pullings could always be relied upon to do wonders in the line of seamanship.
"A romantic prospect, is it not?" said Father Andros.
His anxiety seemed to have diminished, as though he had read Jack's mind, and he spoke quite easily, smiling for perhaps the first time since they came ashore.
"Eh?" said Jack. "Why, I suppose it is."
He straightened and took his bearings. Cape Stavro ran out to the southwest, the long promontory with Marga at its southern base and Kutali at its northern, the two separated by 30 miles of sea, but only 3 of land. Yet those 3 were so mountainous that it was not easy to see how the journey could be made.
"Where is the aqueduct that goes to Marga?" he asked.
"You cannot see it from here," said Andros, "but I can easily show it to you. It is no distance at all, and there is a wild romantic view from the crag above it. I am aware that English travellers are partial to wild romantic views."
"Pray ask him what he means by no distance at all," said Jack.
"Not an hour by the goat's path," said Graham after the translation, "but he says that we could take horse and go by the smooth way, if you do not mind missing the wild romantic view."
"I am afraid that we are not here to indulge ourselves in wild romantic views," said Jack. "Duty requires that we should take horse."
The smooth way led them between the mountains over a firm, springy sward, up and down again to a grassy saddle, where the priest dismounted and said,
"Here."
"Where?"
cried Jack, gazing about for a noble series of arches marching across the landscape.
"Here,"
said the priest again, thumping a limestone slab half buried in the turf.
"Listen."
And bending their heads in the silence, they could hear water running underground. The spring was on Mount Shkrell, and a gently sloping, covered channel carried it all the way to the heights behind Marga.
"You can see it, like a green road following the curves of the hillside, where it plunges straight down, and I will show you many places where it can easily be cut."
Looking down on Marga, Jack felt inclined to say that he would not be in that commanding officer's shoes with his water cut off and a battery opening upon him from such a height, for he had no doubt that although guns and even carronades were notoriously awkward things to carry across country, above all mountainous country, He could move a competent number over this firm, dry turf, keeping to the channel as it followed, or very nearly followed, the contour line, if once he could get them up to the citadel. But he never liked to tempt fate either by land or sea, and he only observed
that perhaps they should be getting back now. He, for one, was so hellish peckish that he could eat an ox and then call for more.
They rode back, therefore, and at a fine pace, the horses eager for their stables, the men for their managers, and on the way they met a Turkish officer. He and Father Andros exchanged a few private words, the language incomprehensible but not the tone of satisfaction, and the priest announced, with what little spontaneity he could summon, that the Bey, having recovered from his indisposition, would be happy to invite Captain Aubrey to a...
"It is an unusual term. Albanian in origin, I believe," said Graham. "Perhaps it should be translated as a snap, a slight or hasty meal."
A more accurate version would have been fat-tailed sheep stewed with saffron, preceded by three made dishes and followed by three more. During part of the feast, so that Graham should have leisure to eat, Sihan spoke through a Moldavian dragoman, telling Jack about the Syrian campaign in 1799, when he and Sir Sidney Smith repelled Bonaparte from Acre, and then about his manoeuvres with the naval brigade in the days that led up to the Battle of Aboukir. Sir Sidney was somewhat too showy to qualify as Jack's favourite public character, but sincere and reasoned praise of the navy, above all from a fighting man as scarred and battered as the Bey, was quite another matter, and Jack looked upon him with great complacency. Though indeed he would have liked his host in any case, a small, compact, grey-bearded man with great natural dignity, direct, and apart from his diplomatic illness and his sending of Father Andros so that the position should be put to Aubrey by a fellow Christian, devoid of artifice. He was much more what Jack had expected of a Turk, a plain man, and one that he could trust. Towards the end of the meal, Sihan said,
"I am happy to learn from Father Andros that you have seen this state of Kutali. I understand that your admiral wishes to be able to use the port for his ships, and that he wishes us to help him expel the French from Marga. If he will give me the cannon, I and the Kutaliots will do our part."
"Very well," said Jack. "I shall send my consort to Cephalonia for the guns as soon as the wind turns into the north."